This is The Big Breakdown, a long look back at some of the biggest stories we're covering for you at the Hidden Killers Podcast and True Crime Today. This is Hidden Killers Live with Tony Bruschi and Robin Dree.
One more case. Seven women allegedly killed across nearly two decades. And for over a decade after that, nothing, no arrest, no suspect named publicly. The Gilgo Beach case sat cold while families buried what they could recover and waited for a system that seemed to have forgotten them. Now, with Rex Heerman reportedly preparing to change his plea to guilty on charges connected to all seven victims, this case enters a brand new phase, one where the questions don't get simpler. They get a little bit harder. Jennifer Coffendaffer is with me and Robin today, retired FBI special agent. Jen, Rex Heerman maintained his innocence for nearly three decades. His defense challenged the DNA, fought the split in the trials, filed motion after motion, and lost every single one. Let's talk about this. As someone who's built cases against violent offenders, when a defendant who's been fighting that hard and has maintained this secrecy, this veil for all of these years, fooling his friends, fooling his family, fooling everybody, he decides now, I'm guilty. What does that tell you about what's really going on behind the scenes?
Behind the scenes, he and his legal staff believe they've exhausted everything. They've exhausted what they can't exhaust. And then that's coupled with the fact that Asa, he's got his daughter, and basically, I don't think he wants to run all of this through the mud. Look, I mean, we already know because of his journals, the absolute salaciousness and nastiness of what he had going on. That's been made public. But can you imagine what that would mean in a trial? He doesn't want, so threefold. One, I think he thinks he's going to lose. Number two, he wants to save his family. And number three, he wants to save himself. And I should probably put that at the top because he doesn't want all of this out here. That's my opinion, why he decided to.
Yeah, so Jen, we were talking about this yesterday too. Totally agree. And I'm with you. I think he's putting himself above his family. Because again, the human in us, people with empathy, think that he would be taking these actions for family. But no, he's incapable, I think, because of what he's done. I think he saw his family as a tool to help him do what he wanted to do to other women. I'm curious, with your experience with people like this, can they use, because the only thing I had as a possibility, information that he can have and still withholds about other potential victims he has might be used as currency. Can he be using that maybe as currency if he can hold that information and control it for himself once he already knows and accepts, all right, I'm going to be behind bars. My only currency I have is more information. Do you think that's a possibility?
I do. And I like where you're going with this. Of course, we're talking about a non-death penalty situation right here. That's usually what these chips are used for. But could it be used for a bargaining tool to get parole? Look, he's not going to get it, so I don't think it's much of a bargaining tool. But I could still see him using it again, like a BTK, to maintain their power and control over the narrative. I absolutely think he could be using it.
But let's talk about like that with BTK for a second, because he's always from behind bars. Left little breadcrumbs. That's what he likes to do. And when people have questioned him on certain cases, he's been either elusive or he's been flat out saying creepy shit like, well, that wasn't my work, which is just kind of gives you shivers when you think about it. Obviously BTK is not out on parole. He's dying in prison right now. But did he get anything that, you know, for little nuggets that he would drop here and there? I mean, was that lever ever fully pulled on his part, or is this something where maybe Heerman could pull it more because the odds that there are several other from Heerman that are connected to him are very high, maybe even more than BTK.
So first of all, I'm going to call him Dennis Rader because I should have called him that. It was my fault. I opened with that because
Danny,
because he wanted to be called that.
Right.
Yeah.
That was his. Call me
mistake too.
Right. So yeah. Rader, first of all, with him, it was kind of interesting because when you look at the later cases that people tried to tie into him, he was almost pissed off.
Yeah.
And look at what he said in court. He wanted to, he was so proud of his work and he wanted it out there and he knew he was caught. Unlike a, you know, what we saw from Brian Koberger, just talking about these cases that I know people are familiar with. When he did this, this was a proud moment. In fact, officers stopped wanting to go see him. They were like tired of hearing the stories over and over again. They didn't want to sit for fireside chats about these murders anymore. That truly happened with Dennis Rader. So with this case, though, he hasn't said anything. I will be very interested to see if he's quiet like Koberger or whether he does more of a Rader or whether he just, you know, what does he do? Is he going to allocate? We're going to see.
Yeah, it's interesting because I get the question, Tony, is like, what can he gain from having that knowledge? And like, what did Rader gain from it? I think what Rader gained, again, I don't know what he gained actually materially in jail from it, maybe nothing, but in here. Remember, the whole reason why serial killers do what they do is the fantasization of what it is they've done. That's why they stage things. That's why they take trophies. And so his every time he needs a hit of a dopamine hit from that, that's when you leak something. That's because then you get the attention. So it's that grandiosity is what gets fed. And so I think that's where he's using that currency to get what matters to him. And so, but to Jen's point exactly, Uehrman comes across very differently. And so it'll be really interesting. Maybe he is more of the material guy. Maybe we were talking about this yesterday. Maybe he can, you know, try to leverage a better place to be incarcerated in or commissary, something. I don't know. But he is a different cat. It definitely looks like it.
Yeah.
Can I full circle real quick, Tony?
Yeah.
To, in large part, why Uehrman was not caught earlier? Because, again, of malfeasance within a police department.
Yeah. Yeah.
And I shouldn't even say malfeasance. That's not the right word. Absolute, because that's more to do with money. Absolute corruptness, actually, in that department. But basically, you have these departments that are in charge that don't have oversight and everything that happened in that case before it was taken over. This case should have been solved so long ago.
Yeah.
So just bring it full circle, obviously. Mm-hmm.
Yep. Leadership, leadership, leadership.
The other question I think that's going to linger out there, and I'm not accusing her of anything whatsoever, because I think in a lot of ways she is a victim of this too. I mean, it almost kind of goes back to like what we were talking about with the cults, with the Duggars and such, where you have adults that have their own autonomy, can make their own decisions and such, but sometimes they're bamboozled into stuff. And I do not know, only she would know and he would know and whoever was in that house would know. Asa Elrip, his wife, obviously maintains her innocence, has never been charged with anything. But again, if this now turns out to be true, Rex did all this, he's admitting to it. So we have that as an established fact. This shit was going on in your house, the house that you lived in. Did you really not know anything? And I think it's an interesting question because she may have known things, but not the context of them. And I think that plays a key part in any of this. Do you foresee anything? Again, not accusing her of anything, but do you foresee anything of her possibly being charged with anything in this? Or is that, would that have already have taken place now that we're this many years in since after his arrest?
I don't think she will be charged with anything. Do I think she knew? Listen, I would just ask this of everybody.
Yeah.
In your house, with your spouse, with your significant other, do you think you would not see the breadcrumbs that were more like, instead of breadcrumbs, that were boulders that were laying out for you in your house, the secret room, the, you know, leaving, the coming? You remember there are other witnesses that said they went to the house, and one said, as I recall, that she saw Asa. So
yeah,
I just do not buy, again, the whole ostrich situation. I just don't buy it. To what degree? I don't know.
Yeah.
But you saw what happened when, I mean, she didn't talk about Pulp Fiction. She didn't look surprised at all.
No, I mean, but I mean, there's also a lot of shame that comes with accepting those sort of things as normal and then admitting to the fact that you saw these things but didn't connect the dots for what they were. Now, it's one thing if she was, and I'm not saying she was, but there's been accusations out there of she was involved in some of the S parties and things of that nature. None of that's been confirmed. That's just the accusations that have floated out there and by other people. I mean, that's one thing if you're aware of, I mean, but I guess, I mean, let's just throw it out there. That's not illegal if someone, I mean, as long as you're not like involving illegal activity, if that's someone's lifestyle and that's what they're into, who knows? That's not illegal. I mean, she could have been involved in some kind of dark shit that was not illegal, just, I guess, morally questionable to whoever is making the judgment on it. And if that would be true, that may just be the end of it. And she may think, well, this is as depraved as it gets, not really realizing it's dark and depraved as it really goes. Robin speaks to that a little bit. I mean, shame is a very powerful factor in what people will be accountable for and also what they will tell themselves and what they will accept themselves as they're moving through life to get through day by day.
Yeah, and it goes to that self-identity. So shame, self-identity, if any of these things, any of his behaviors challenge that and challenge her decision-making process, especially she seems connected to her kids, you know, the thought of not being a good mother, not being able to protect her children from this, that is so hard for us to overcome and to face. So there's a lot of deniability going on inside. And shame, again, shame's a powerful weapon. It is shame and fear. That is what drives the negative behaviors that we can sometimes inflict on ourselves and others.
It's going to be interesting. With the fact that, you know, they got Heuermann alleged, you know, he was, you know, allegedly into this scene. If they catch others in this circle, would we ever know that it was connected to Rex? I'm wondering, from an investigative standpoint in the background, do you think they were able to get more leads out of this whole scenario to hopefully take down others? And would we know if any of that would be connected?
You know, Heuermann, I believe, was very private.
Yeah.
What he did. I don't imagine he wanted to share and be in necessarily groups because he was smart enough and able to lure these individuals into victimize by targeting all by himself. Mm-hmm. And he was very, very good at his craft with all the different cell phones and how he practiced his trade. So when you look at that, I wouldn't expect any tentacles with somebody because he was so private in what he did. Yeah. What do you think?
I'm curious whether he got more hair. The fact that he appeared in later years to get sloppy, because as time passes and you're not caught, I think you tend to get sloppy. And also, as law enforcement's techniques advanced, his techniques and didn't, I don't think, as much as law enforcement was outpacing him. And that's why one of the reasons why I think he got caught. And so I'd be really curious, as he got sloppy, you know, what other evidence do they have of other potential victims that they can start triangulating on? So I don't know. But I think, like you said, I think there's more. It'll be interesting whether they have any data that it'll help them try to locate them.
Or is Rex the amazing one-man show at the end of the day? I don't know. That's the question. Your thoughts in the comments on Substack and YouTube. We'd love for you to weigh in and give us your thoughts. And be sure to press subscribe wherever you're downloading podcasts. Robin's new book, it's out. It's Not All About Me. Get it wherever you get books. Put it in an Easter basket.
Yes.
For your loved ones. Give it to your children. Say, kids, no eggs this year. You just get Robin's.
Such a horrible gift, isn't it?
Happy Easter.
Get that in a lump of coal.
Go make me an omelet. All right. Of course, Jennifer Coffendaffer, as always, thank you for being here. Until next time, for Todd, Robin, and Jen, I'm Tony Bruschi. We'll talk again real soon.
Want more on this case and others? Then press subscribe now and don't miss a moment of true crime coverage from Tony Bruschi and the Hidden Killers podcast. This is Hidden Killers with Tony Bruschi. Here now, Tony Bruschi.
For more than 30 years, Sandra Costello's murder belonged to someone else. Investigators spent years trying to pin it on John Bitteroff, a convicted killer from the area who'd already been linked to two other women's deaths. Bitteroff lived in Marionville. He had the profile, he had the proximity, and for a long time, that was enough to keep investigators circling back to him, even when they couldn't quite make it stick. Meanwhile, according to prosecutors, the man who's DNA ended up on Sandra's body was building an architecture career in Manhattan, commuting from a quiet house on Long Island, raising kids, living completely undisturbed. Sandra was 28 years old when she was found. She had come to New York from Trinidad and Tobago, and if the prosecution's case holds, she wasn't just another cold case. She was the beginning. It was the first documented beginning in this horror story that we're about to break our way through here in the next week or so. We're going to be breaking down the individual stories of all seven of the victims of Rex Zimmerman. But wait, there might be more. Yeah, there might be. We're going to cover the seven that have been confirmed over the next 5 days through seven individual pieces, seven individual monologue commentaries here where we are going to talk about who each individual person was and how they ended up being connected to Rex Zimmerman, because they deserve that. Not just to be lumped in as a number, 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, but as a name, an identity, a story of the human beings that they were. Rex Zimmerman was 30 years old back in 1993, not a middle-aged man hiding behind a suburban facade, not a father using his family's travel schedule as cover, just a young architect at the start of his career, and prosecutors allege the start of something else entirely. Here's what makes Sandra's story different from the others in this series and what makes it harder to tell. We know almost nothing about her life. Not in the way we know about Melissa Barthelemy's dream of owning a salon, or Maureen Brainerd Barnes fighting to keep custody of her kids, or Amber Costello's roommates describing her as a kind of person who'd give you the shirt off her back. Sandra doesn't have those details in the public record. What we know is clinical. She was from Trinidad and Tobago. She was living in New York City at the time of her disappearance, and her body was found in November of 1993. That absence of personal detail isn't a footnote, it's the story. Sandra Costello existed in a space where a woman could be murdered. And the full picture of who she was could simply evaporate. No one preserved it. No one amplified it. And for three decades, no one was held accountable for ending it. The year is 1993. Think about what that means for the case. There is no Craigslist. There's no back page, no digital trail of burner phones pinging off cell towers and mapping a suspect's movements in real time. The tools that would eventually tie Zimmerman to the Gilgo 4, the cell phone forensic, the internet search histories, the abandonment DNA from a discarded pizza crust, none of that exists yet. Some of it's science fiction. Most of the population can't contemplate of the tools that will be used as evidence to convict this man, even existing at this point in time. Whatever happened to Sandra happened in an analog world. And the evidence that allegedly connects Zimmerman to her death comes down to something almost absurdly simple. Hair. Sandra's body was found on November 19th, 1993, by hunters in a wooded area off Fish Cove Road in Northsea in the town of Southampton, not on Gilgo Beach, not along Ocean Parkway, not in the Bramble where the Gilgo 4 would be discovered 17 years later. She was found roughly 60 miles east of where those women ended up. The location alone is part of why nobody connected her to the pattern that would emerge decades later. The geography didn't match. The timeline didn't match. The assumed profile of the killer didn't match. North Sea is out on the eastern end of Long Island, past the suburbs, past the commuter towns, in the kind of area where wooded parcels sit empty for years and bodies can go undiscovered for months. If not for the hunters and their dogs, there's no telling how long Sandra would have lain there. The remoteness of the site suggests someone who knew the terrain, who had a reason to drive that far east, and a familiarity with places where people don't go. According to prosecutors, Sandra had suffered numerous sharp force injuries. The specifics of the crime scene have been held close by the prosecution, but what's been disclosed paints a picture of violence that goes beyond the act of killing. Injuries that suggest rage or control or something worse. And then her case went cold. Investigators explored the Bitteroff connection for years. Bitteroff was convicted in 2017 of murdering two women in the early 1990s, Rita Tangerdi and Colleen McNamee, whose remains were found in Marionville. The geographic overlap was real. The timeline overlap for a while. Bitteroff was the best theory anyone had for Sandra's death, but they could never make the evidence work. There was no forensic link, no confession, no witness. Sandra stayed in the unsolved column. And then in 2024, Suffolk County District Attorney Ray Tierney's team made an announcement that rewrote the entire Gilgo Beach timeline using advanced DNA analysis, specifically techniques that were not available when Sandra's life ended. They weren't available when the Gilgo 4 were found. It had never been used in a New York courtroom before. Prosecutors said they matched hairs found on Sandra's body to Rex Heuermann with what they described as 99.96% certainty. A second hair recovered from Sandra's remains allegedly matched a female in Heuermann's household. According to prosecution findings, two hairs, 31 years later. That's what allegedly tied the earliest known victim to the man prosecutors say went on a killing spree for nearly two more decades. Sit with that for a second. Because the defense had a response to this. And it's worth hearing. Herman's defense attorney, Daniel Koyish, argued in a January 26 court filing that the prosecution's evidence linking Heuermann to Sandra Costello amounts to, in her words, a single hair on a shirt. The defense challenged the DNA technology as novel, untested, and unreliable. They filed a massive, ominous motion seeking to dismiss the Costello charge entirely, arguing the evidence was not legally sufficient to establish the offense. They wanted the grand jury, the minutes of that, open. They wanted the charge thrown out. Defense attorney Michael Brown told reporters that hearing that there were some real significant issues the defense was bringing to the court's attention, Judge Timothy, his response was, "Thanks for that." Drew scattered chuckles in the courtroom. And then the judge denied the motion. The DNA evidence was ruled admissible. The charge stands. One of the many nails in the coffin for Rex Heuermann. But here's something you need to understand about this particular charge and why it carries weight that goes beyond the forensics. If the prosecution is right about Sandra Costello, it fundamentally changes what this case is. Before Sandra, the Gilgo Beach case was understood to have started in 2007, the year Maureen Brainerd Barnes disappeared. That was the earliest confirmed connection to the pattern. The Craigslist ads, the burner phones, the petite women bound in burlap and left in the brush along Ocean Parkway, the timeline that investigators built, the profile they constructed, the narrative the public absorbed, all of it, assuming a killing window of roughly 3 years from 07 to 10. Then Jessica Taylor pushed the timeline back a little bit, 2003. Then Valerie Mack pushed it back to 2000. And Sandra Costello pushed it all the way back to 1993. The Bodyguard had just come out. Sleepless in Seattle was a new movie. Meaning, according to prosecutors, this allegedly went back at least 17 years. Not a compressed burst of violence, not a three-year spree, a span that covers almost two full decades, during which Hierman allegedly graduated from killing in the early 90s to refining his methods, acquiring burner phones, building digital planning documents, and leaving behind evidence that would take the most advanced forensic technology available to decode. And the implications don't stop at the timeline. If Hierman was allegedly doing this in 1993, he was doing it before he had children, before the marriage that prosecutors say became his cover. The family whose travel schedule allegedly dictated when he could act, before the suburban facade, before the Massapequa Park house that the prosecution describes as a crime scene. In 1993, according to this theory, he was a young man years away from the life that would eventually make his neighbors describe him as a family man who kept to himself. That raises a question that prosecutors haven't publicly answered and that the defense has no interest in answering. If this started in 93 and there are other victims between Sandra, or are there other victims between Sandra Costella and Valerie Mack? The next known case is in 2000. It's a 7-year gap. 7 years between the first and second killings for someone prosecutors describe as methodical, compulsive, and driven by documented fantasies of violence. 7 years of inactivity seems rather unlikely. The prosecution hasn't commented on that gap, but you can bet that investigators have thought about it. The planning document the prosecutors say they found on the laptop in Hierman's basement, the one written in all caps with checklists for before, during, and after each alleged killing, that document didn't come out of nowhere. Prosecutors have described it as refined, an evolved system. Notes on sleep before the hunt. Reminders to clean the bodies, instructions to destroy evidence, a post-event checklist with entries like burn gloves, dispose of picks, and have a story set. That kind of operational refinement doesn't appear fully formed. It develops, it iterates, it learns from mistakes. In Sandra Costello's case, if the prosecution is correct, represents the earliest known data point in that evolution. The man prosecutors describe in 2010 with burner phones and digital checklists and a methodology for targeting vulnerable women was, in their theory, a product of years of practice that allegedly began with Sandra. And consider the physical evidence itself. In 1993, there were no burner phones, no Craigslist ads to trace, no digital planning documents to discover on a hard drive. Whatever methodology Hierman allegedly used that year was analog, in person, face to face, without the electronic trail that would eventually be his undoing decades later. The fact that he allegedly left almost nothing behind in Sandra's case except hair, no digital evidence, no phone records, no internet searches, is itself a data point. It suggests that whatever happened in 1993 happened in a world where the killer had fewer tools and fewer traces. The technology that prosecutors used to build their case against him in the Gilgo 4 murders didn't exist when Sandra died, and the technology that eventually linked him to her death, advanced mitochondrial DNA, didn't exist either. She was killed in a forensic blind spot and sat there for 31 years, longer than her actual life. Sandra came to this country from Trinidad and Tobago. She was living in New York City. She was 28 years old. And that's almost everything the public record tells us about who she was before she was found in the woods of Southampton. The details of her inner life, her relationships, her aspirations, her personality, they aren't in court filings or in the press coverage or in the documentaries. And that's not because those details don't matter. It's because the systems that were supposed to pay attention to her failed. Not just in death, but in memory. There's something profoundly wrong about a case where the accused killer's planning documents get more analysis than the victim's life. Where we know what he allegedly wrote in all caps on a laptop in his basement, the checklists, the reminders, the post-event protocols, but we can't tell you what Sandra Costello liked to do on a Saturday afternoon. That imbalance isn't accidental. It reflects who gets remembered and who gets reduced to a case number. It reflects what the system prioritizes when it finally gets around to paying attention. Of all the charges Heuermann faces, this may be the one built on the thinnest publicly known evidence, and yet the one that reveals the most about how long this allegedly went on. The defense called it a single hair on a shirt. The prosecution calls it a 99.96% DNA match to a man they say went on to kill at least six more women over the next 17 years. The judge called it admissible. And the public is left to sit with the fact that a woman from Trinidad and Tobago had her life taken in the woods of Long Island in 1993, and it took three decades, a complete revolution in forensic technology, and the unraveling of an entirely separate set of murders for anyone to connect her death to a name. Sandra Costello was 28. She deserved better than an unsolved file. She deserved better than being confused with someone else's victims. She deserves better than 30 years of silence. And if the evidence holds, this was the first time in a pattern that wouldn't fully surface for another generation. Your thoughts in the comments section on Substack and YouTube. The links are in our descriptions. Do you really think he went dark from 93 to 2000? Or do you think there's a whole other set of people, maybe even more than he's already being charged with, just waiting for their names to be recognized and connected to the monster that is Rex Heuermann? Your thoughts in the comments section on Substack and YouTube. We'll continue it there. Until then, I'm Tony Bruschi. We'll talk again real soon.
Want more on this case and others? Then press subscribe now and don't miss a moment of true crime coverage from Tony Bruschi and the Hidden Killers podcast.
Here's what happened when one journalist reported on DEI programs.
I decided to just focus on the University of Michigan. I obtained internal documents that showed that the school had spent about $250 million on DEI programs. I spent 2 weeks in Ann Arbor talking to everybody I could find. The unintended consequences of these programs, they had sort of left everybody dissatisfied. And this expensive machinery the school had built just imploded. If you're a journalist, you are not on anyone's team. All you're trying to do is figure out as many of the facts as you can gather. The facts are going to guide you to where the story lands. You're not taking sides. I'm Nick Confessori. I'm an investigations reporter for the New York Times.
Journalists like Nick follow the facts wherever they lead. They go where news breaks, get answers firsthand, and publish what they find. That's fact-based reporting. Seek it out if you don't already.